From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made about 50 years ago, when the average age of men and women getting married was about 6 or 7 years younger than it is today. In fact, you go back to the 1950s, and the average woman who got married at 20. The average man, at 23. In 2004, the average woman got married at age 26. The average man, 27. Today, the average woman gets married at 27, and the average man at 29. Is that behind a change in the statistics when it comes to the divorce rate? Well, we heard from Tully Rinke, a law firm that has been looking at some of the numbers, that the divorce rate is falling. And I've got Edward McLenathan on the phone with us from Tully Rinke, and Ed can help us understand what is going on out there. Ed, how are you?
Good, and yourself?
Very good. Thanks for taking the time. I mean, I had to dig up the numbers in terms of the age people get married, because a friend of mine recently said, well, I think people are having kids later. And I said, well, does that mean we're getting married later? And it looks like the answer to that is yes, but I don't know if that ties into the divorce rate. What are we seeing with the divorce rate in our region?
Well, we're definitely seeing a correlation in the number of divorces going down with people getting married later. But we're also seeing less people getting married at all. That has dropped pretty significantly over the past 10 to 12 years.
And so when it comes to the divorce rate now, where did this number come from? Every time it comes up, I hear someone say, well, you know, half of all marriages end in divorce, half of all marriages. That is not true, is it?
Well, I don't really know what the percent of the marriages that end in divorce is anymore. But I can tell you that the number of people getting married is dropping, and that's from the CDC. In 2000, you saw about 8.2% of the population getting married. In 2012, most recent data that we've looked at, it's dropped to 6.8% of people getting married. That has to have an impact on the number of divorces.
The number we're also seeing is if you are over the age of 50, there are 1 in 20, 50 years ago, over the age of 50, had never been married. And that number is about double that today. So interesting that we're seeing some of those changes in our society. And I don't know if that will level off or if it will make an impact. But Ed, I also want to ask you about same-sex marriage, because we now have several years of same-sex marriage under our belt. Is that impacting the divorce rate?
I think we're going to see that in the next couple years. We hear a lot about the 7-year itch. Statistically, it's really a 4 or 5-year itch. That seems to be the years of marriage when divorce happens with folks that whose marriage does not survive the first 10 years. Year 4 and year 5 are the most frequently divorced years. And we're quickly approaching years 4 and 5 of same-sex marriage.
So years 4 and 5. So does that mean that 2 or 3 years from now, it is possible or likely we'll see the divorce rate go back up?
I think you're going to see that with starting with around 2016, probably continuing through about 2018, bearing in mind that it's still the vast minority of people getting married are in same-sex relationships. But this is going to be the first wave of those folks that have chosen to exercise their right under New York state law. That's going to be their first time when they hit this 4 or 5 year itch.
We're talking to Ed McLenathan from Tully Rinke. That is a law firm that, Ed, your focus is family law?
Family, matrimonial. I've done a smattering of a few other things, but these days it's largely family and matrimonial.
Okay, and I recall a conversation with a friend who was, they had moved back to the Finger Lakes, and he was working here and his wife was still working in Manhattan, and she would come home on the weekends. And he said, well, you know, the average marriage only lasts 8.5 years anyway, so we figure maybe we get 16 out of this, that we're stretching our lifetime of marriage together. And he was kidding, of course. I don't know where he got 8.5 years, but Ed, you're saying years 4 and 5 are the most perilous, yes?
Yes. If you get to year 10 and beyond, you're in pretty good shape. But if you don't get to year 10, chances are it was year 5 and year 4 that you got divorced.
How often are you working on cases that are marriages that went double digits?
Well, what I'm also seeing a lot of these days is folks that have been living as separate individuals and not as a married couple, but they're still married. They may have a formal separation agreement in place, and they may have been divorced, they may have been living separately for 10, 15 years, and now they're kind of finally getting around to formalizing the divorce.
What about no-fault law? I hear a lot of questions about no-fault and how that impacts proceedings. What's the impact there?
Well, we did see a substantial bump in the divorce rate in 2010 when the no-fault law was passed. New York was, I guess not surprisingly, the last state to adopt no-fault divorce legislation. I like to think it's because they were taking their time and trying to do it right. We did see an increase in 2010 when that law was passed. What New York's law says is that one of the spouses has to say, this marriage is irretrievably broken down, and I've felt that way for 6 months or more. And then you can get into court, and you can get your divorce.
And I guess they called that a bounce 5 years ago, but that's not impacting anymore, huh?
It seems to have leveled off. I suspect, but I don't know, that in 2010 you had a number of people that were waiting for their grounds for divorce to sort of kick in, whether it was being apart from each other or whether it was proving some of the other grounds that were necessary in New York. And 2010 comes along, and now you've got irretrievable breakdown, and a bunch of people said, well, we're not waiting anymore. We're going to divorce court now. And you saw that bump over those first couple of years. That sort of leveled off. And to kind of bring us back around to our first point, fewer people are getting married. I think if you looked hard into this data, what you're going to see is that, let me back up. People got married for one of two reasons, typically, because they were in love or because there were children involved. The stigma of having a child out of wedlock is almost gone. And so I think that you're seeing people just not getting married because of that reason anymore. And that inevitably is going to lead to less divorces.
Looking at also the numbers, I suppose this shouldn't be all that surprising. But I've been digging through the New York Times and Time magazine have reported extensively on some of these recent trends of divorce, and they're still finding the kind of trends that you would expect. For example, if you get married younger than 26 and you don't have a college degree, 51% are going to be divorced by the time they get to that double-digit year. So more than half of those marriages end in divorce by year 10 if you are younger than 26 and don't have a college degree. But here's the good news. If you are over the age of 26 and you have a college degree, 81% make at least 20 years, are still married at least 20 years later. So only 1 in 5 are divorced within 20 years if you're getting married later than the age of 26 and you have a college degree. That probably doesn't surprise you. What do you think, Ed?
It doesn't surprise me at all. Marriage is one of the most serious risks you can take in a lot of ways. You are investing your whole life in another person and in a relationship. And I don't know about you, but when I was 20 years old, I'm not sure if I had my feet fully on the ground. I certainly was not financially secure enough to lay a foundation for a long-term relationship. And I think, if you have that college degree, you've gone through a period of time where you've lived on your own, you know what your lifestyle is like, and you presumably got a better financial footing. All those things are going to add to the success of your marriage.
Talking to Ed McLenathan from Tully Rinke, and we're talking about the decline in divorce rates. The numbers compiled based on Vital Statistics of New York State data that Tully Rinke compiled. Ed, I'm looking down the list here. So the Finger Lakes region, down 12.5% in divorces. Yates County down 32%. Monroe County nearly 18%. So it is happening in a lot of different places, isn't it?
It is. And I would beg to say it's across the board. I don't know if we can identify all the factors leading to that, but I think we've hit on a couple of them so far today. That's the reduction in the number of marriages to begin with, both in a per capita sense and in overall hard numbers, the fact that it just doesn't seem to be as popular a decision right now.
All right, so give us one more takeaway before we let you go, Ed. What do we look at these numbers, and should we be optimistic about marriage, optimistic about our decision-making? What's your takeaway from this?
Well, I would hope that we can be optimistic and say people are thinking more about this commitment before they get married. But as I look at the numbers, I think a major contributor to this is that we just don't get married because of kids anymore. I don't know if that's good or bad as a societal position. I guess you could say it's good because you don't want kids growing up in an argumentative environment. I guess you could also say it's bad because there is some value to an intact family. I'll leave that to smarter people.
Yeah.
And I will just conclude by saying, think carefully before you get into a marriage, and think carefully before you need to get out of it. They are highly emotional, highly complex situations, and you can't do it alone.
But Ed, if everyone did that, your phone may ring less at Tony Rinke.
I will tell you, if I am out of a job because there are divorces, I'd be okay with that. I'm sure there'd be something else for me to do.
I also think it's unfortunately highly unlikely that that would ever come to pass. Ed McLenathan from Tully Rinke Law Firm here in Rochester, thank you for taking the time to break down the numbers and share your expertise with us.
My pleasure.
All right, we're going to take a short break, and we're going to talk about an event coming this weekend. We had planned to talk today to Gail Sheehy, an award-winning journalist and author. She's got bronchitis, but that's okay because there is someone in my studio who has no bronchitis and no shortage of insight into Gail's visit, her impact on careers like hers. So much to talk about as we take a 60-second break and talk about what's coming up next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. I have been reading and reading and reading a 600-page memoir called Daring My Passages. It's the newest book from award-winning journalist Gail Sheehy, who is returning to Rochester March 1st. That's this weekend. She's speaking as part of the Jewish Book Festival at the JCC, and she started her career at the Democrat and Chronicle 50 years ago. And we had hoped to have Gail on. She came down with bronchitis. But let me introduce someone who is excited that Gail is coming. That's Pam Sherman, the suburban outlaw, a leadership consultant, a professor, a writer, an actor, I guess a recovering attorney, Pam?
Yes. That's why I was so interested in he was okay with being out of a job.
Yes. You're okay with changing careers or trying new things. You've done that many times. But Pam is excited that Gail is coming. And give me a sense for what's coming up this weekend with Gail Sheehy.
Well, actually, this is really a signature event of the Jewish Book Festival. And Lori Harder, the executive director, would have been here as well, but she's traveling. So I'm so excited because in many ways, the JCC has been a cultural home for me. My book was in the festival a few years ago. My one-woman show was produced there. And I've watched what they've been doing and growing the festival. So to have it all year round and not just in the fall, I think is brilliant. But to bring someone of the stature of Gail Sheehy to Rochester and to do it in conjunction with Jewish Senior Life. Actually, I guess the auditorium wasn't big enough for Gail Sheehy, so they're doing this over at the Jewish Home and doing it in conjunction with Jewish Senior Life. And it's part of Lori's strategy to have more partnerships in the community. Mm-hmm. But Gail Sheehy is an iconic journalist, writer, and frankly, female advocate. And as we start Women's History Month, it couldn't be a better day for her to come to Rochester, back to where she started her career.
So can people still get involved and go see her?
They can, and they can find tickets at thejewishjcc.org. And that's actually getting close to sold out, which is amazing. I think it shows how excited people are to hear the stories that she has to share, her perspective. And she touches so many audiences, Evan, if you think about it. She touches people who are interested in political journalism. She touches those women who had passages and then all the subsequent versions of passages on their nightstand. I remember seeing it on my mother's nightstand and wondering what is that all about? And now I'm the age that my mother was when she had it on her nightstand. So she really has a perspective about the world, being a global citizen of the world. But I think she really will touch a lot of audiences, not only the audiences that would be interested in the fact that she's in her 70s and still going strong. Despite the bronchitis, I'm glad she's preserving her voice.
I couldn't agree more. I understand completely. Passages, I think, was 40 years ago now.
It was.
The first Passages, I should say.
Right.
The first of many subsequent versions of Passages. But even beyond that, you go back 50 years to her career in Rochester. The story of her getting work in Rochester is a reminder of how much the world's changed, but how much, I hope it's changed. She talks about getting work. Worked at the Democrat and Chronicle, and she had a lot of love for people at the Democrat and Chronicle, but like a lot of women, still now, but really much more overtly at the time, there were concerns of, well, you might be having babies, you know?
I couldn't believe when I read that in the book. You know, I had the chance to talk to her before I wrote my column about her and weaving her into Women's History Month and my philosophy. And she started telling me the story of the fact that she'd moved here as a spouse. I mean, that is a very Rochester story, right? I moved here for my spouse. And
I moved here for my spouse.
There we go. Right. So we're not making this gender specific, but it's very,
I think
it's a Rochester phenomenon. So she moved here when her first husband was a medical student and they didn't have any money. So she had to make money, and she was actually, I think she told me that she started out at, was it McCurdy's?
Yeah.
Doing fashion shows.
Yep.
And she got a call from her friend who wrote the fashion column at the DNC and said, get down here. And she still had to make the case for why she should get the job when she was just going to leave and have babies, which blew me away. I mean, I actually got that in the 1990s. But I loved her response, which was, I didn't think I was coming here to have an interview about pregnancy.
Yeah, it was a great response. But what was interesting was, I think she was 23 at mm-hmm. the time. And so you're reading this thinking, oh, the concern is that she's too young for the job. The concern was not that Gail Sheehy was too young, but that you might be having babies.
Right.
And we really, you know, can't risk hiring someone who might actually become pregnant. My goodness, you know. But you're saying in the 1990s?
So I'll never forget this. As a lawyer, I probably felt it a bit. You know, what's going to happen? And could she be a partner? Left the practice of law when my law firm closed down. I went to choose my path to be an actor. So excited in Washington, D.C., great community for theater, film, and television. I had my audition for Sheer Madness, developed here at GIVA, the longest running show in American theater history. I will never forget going in. I had just had my son, now going to be 19 in a month. And the director looks at me and he says, well, how are you going to be in the show 10 shows a week for a year and a half, whatever the contract was going to be, with a new baby? And I looked at him and I said, so maybe you don't know this about me, but I used to be a lawyer and you're not allowed to ask me that question. And I got the job. I mean, it was a really brave response, if you think about it. Maybe it was not such a brave. Maybe that's why I got the job. I was afraid of getting sued. And I think that's what you said. The difference is now we have the kinds of laws that protect us from that. But people don't always use them, Evan. That's the point. I don't think she would have. She wanted the job.
Yeah. And Pam and I were talking about this before the program started this hour, that if Gail Sheehy was trying to get a job 50 years ago in Rochester and was told, well, you can't be having babies, or, you know, I don't know if we should hire you. You can't do that anymore. But I don't believe for a second that women are treated exactly the same as men and aren't viewed with some suspicion at times because of that same scenario. It's just less overt.
And that's why she's so iconic, if you think about it. She had that baby with that husband and then was brave enough, frankly, to say, this isn't working. The circumstances contributed to that, his infidelity. I don't know if that was in your statistics on divorce.
Well, you know.
But she said, I'm leaving. And she started raising that child alone on the Lower East Side while still, she took no alimony. Think about that. This is fascinating, actually, coming after your last interview.
Yeah.
And then decided to raise that child while working freelance and trying to make her way. And it was really interesting. She said, you know, I wanted to be in that urban grit. That was how she saw herself. And, you know, she didn't grow up in the middle of Manhattan. She, you know, grew up in the suburbs with a dad who went to work and a mom who stayed home and, you know, challenges in her childhood. But she saw herself as part of an urban, gritty revolution in journalism and wanted to be at the center of it. And think of the opportunities she had when she took that route to be a single mother and how brave and how daring it was, which is the title of her new book and her memoir, Daring My Passages. I don't know. I mean, I think it was pretty brave of me to leave the practice of law, but even then, my law firm went out of business. I didn't have much of a choice. She chose to leave her husband, raise his kid alone, and it took her on a path in the middle of a great revolution in journalism.
Yeah, it was a time where, especially where people thought, well, you're not going to be able to do that. And she did that. And we're talking to Pam Sherman, the suburban outlaw, who is here talking about Gail Sheehy's upcoming visit. That's March 1st. How many days? What are we, 3 days away or something?
We are, and you can still get tickets. So, you know, go online, get on the phone. I really do feel like this is a great Rochester connection. The fact that she started her career here, that she's coming here, and this is the kind of programming that I know is moving the mission of the Jewish Book Festival to make this a community-wide festival that really celebrates culture and connections and collaboration in Rochester.
Well, so you can check her out and see it there. And Pam is talking about Gail, and we're going to talk throughout this hour about some of the really important work. I say important. I think it is. I think a lot of what Gail did was important. But let's sort of peel back her impact on a more broad-looking scale and tell me about, personally, her impact on you.
It's funny because as I picked up the book, I'm like, oh, yeah, Gail Sheehy. I don't think I realized how much she impacted me until I started reading her story. First of all, new journalism was all about personal stories. In my work, I don't think I could write a column called The Suburban Outlaw, which, by the way, is tongue-in-cheek. I keep getting people saying, you're not a real outlaw. I'm like, I know.
Yes.
I know. But that idea that
I have a sense of humor, yes.
Well, that I could tell stories about myself and make them connect to stories in our community and around the world that move me, that came out of new journalism. I think the other thing is, in my business, I'm passionate about helping business leaders share their stories with passion and energy. So I get to travel all over the world working with business leaders from Sydney, Australia to, I've been from Morocco to Milwaukee, Saudi Arabia to Sydney. This year I'll be doing a tour of Nigeria and South Africa. And that takes a bit of daring to go and work with business leaders all over the world and have them share their stories. I think, you know, look how brave she was, jetting off to Northern Ireland, going to interview the Maharishi in India. It's that kind of woman who took the reins. She was strong. She had stories to tell. That's absolutely an influence in my work today, in what I do in my business life. And it surely is connected to my public life as the suburban outlaw.
You use the term new journalism. How do you define it?
I think it's about understanding character.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not, again, you have far greater experts here and you are yourself. I am very clear that I'm not an actual journalist. I just play one on TV. But this idea that we care about the why of our subjects, the character of our politicians, I think that's really changed. And she was part of that influence with what she's written in her profiles in Vanity Fair. and profiles of George Bush and Robert Kennedy and the Clintons and Margaret Thatcher, I don't think we could have the kind of discourse that we have about our politicians without the kind of work that she did.
We're going to talk a bit about the Clintons coming up here. And that's one of my regrets with Gail not being able to join us today. Again, Gail Sheehy getting over bronchitis, and she hopes to be fully over bronchitis by Sunday. You know, the work that she's done on the Clintons and how that story continues to play out. I would have loved to hear about that. But I'm going to get to that with Pam in a moment. My wife flagged an article for me last night, the New York Times wrote, in which Hillary Clinton's team is talking about how they're going to embrace the notion of the woman candidate in 2016.
Oh, thank God.
More than 2008.
I'm sorry. Did I say that out loud?
But before we even get there, I will also say that before Gail Sheehy was writing a lot of these profiles, when she was writing essays and some longer form stuff, she did a lot of daring things, occasionally even surprising her husband by what she was going out wearing to kind of infiltrate certain stories. And sometimes she might have grown, I wonder if she went back and regretted some of it, but that was daring. And that's the title of the book. And not every daring endeavor is pulled off perfectly, but that's life, right, Pam?
Right. And I think that was the best piece of advice that I took from her is when she said to me, dream big. Because if you dream dangerously big, then the possibilities are endless. The second piece of advice she said is act confidently. Literally, take acting classes, learn how to speak, which is thrilling to me, given my business. But then the third thing, she's take the dare. Even if you fall short of it, there's learning in that. And that, I think, is very much about her relationship with Clay Felker. She quoted him and said that's what he told her to do. Because if you don't take the dare, what's the point? So as I was thinking about it, I'm negotiating to travel to Nigeria, and I thought, what am I doing? You know what? Take the dare. What might I learn from the stories that I hear from people who are trying to make a difference for their community there? I know every time I take the dare, even if I fall short, I never regret it. She reminded me of that, and I certainly will continue with that.
Talking to Pam Sherman, and you can find her work in many forms in many places, but where can people read, for people who are not currently actually reading you, Pam?
So I appear weekly in the Democrat and Chronicle on Saturday mornings and, of course, digitally everywhere, and in Rochester Magazine monthly. And you and I, we occupy a social media sphere also on Facebook and on Twitter. My family makes fun of me for it, but I love having that instant discourse on at Suburban Outlaw for Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah, it's an instant way to do it. I wonder, again, what Gail would say about how her career might have been different if that social media had existed. And we're not going back, right? I mean, this world is not returning to an age where everyone reads books in physical hard form and there is no internet. As much as I get nostalgic for that and was happy to have grown up without it, we are not going back.
Well, that's why I loved her 600-page book. The heft of it is it's a real life there, as opposed to my
pages.
Kindle, which, you know,
right.
If I had put it on I was traveling last week and I schlepped it with me. And I'm so glad I did, because it felt like it had ballast. There was muscle, you know, there was a strength to that. And I miss that sometimes in reading on the internet. But that's for another show.
That is weaponized literature.
It is.
That is really, you could really hurt somebody with her book, Gail Sheehy's book, Daring My Passages. She is going to be in Rochester, back in Rochester. And I know, excited to be back in Rochester, and has said that she holds a lot of affinity for us. And that sort of feels like a yay, yay, rah, rah, cheerleading us. But I think it's true with her, isn't it, Pam?
Well, I think wherever you start your career is the place, your launching pad. And so you feel fondly towards that. And even though there might have been challenges, obviously, never saw her husband managing, trying to manage the career. She was the breadwinner. Look, Rochester provides so many opportunities. You know, I always say that moving to Rochester from Washington, D.C. widened my horizons in ways I never could have imagined because of all the opportunities and possibilities that there are here. And that's not rah-rah. That's actually true.
Yeah, I think that's well said, because a lot of people would think, well, if you move to Rochester from D.C., you're narrowing your horizons. And that's not always true. And as much as I think about my first job in Charleston, West Virginia, and feel somewhat fortunate to have put plenty of distance between now and then. If I were back in Charleston, I bet you it would be a blast for me. For a day, but it would be fun.
And so I think that's going to be fun for her to come here, but also to get her message across at the Jewish home. I know that she was connected to that. She lost her husband, Clay Felker, the iconic founder and editor of New York Magazine, which I still receive to this day.
Yeah.
So I'm like a voyeur on my past life as a New Yorker. But she lost him at a Jewish senior life facility. And so she's very connected to that. And I think it will be meaningful for her to speak to that audience. And of course, all the members of the public will come and listen to her.
That was some of the most vulnerable and poignant stuff in her book.
I feel like the memoir of her past is a sort of a guide to all of our futures. And isn't that right? You know, understanding where you've come from and then seeing how she's acted with grace and dignity through the loss of the great love of her life it gives me some comfort. You know, having just celebrated our 30th wedding anniversary, again, a statistic that works. I felt that was so poignant to me. I think they had a very turbulent and tumultuous affair throughout their lives, married for a portion of it, unmarried for most of it. He was both mentor and champion for her. And I think, but it was mainly a great love affair. And that was wonderful to read and to see how she managed that transition, that passage.
The book, During My Passages was 1975, but she hit so many different subjects over the years, including menopause, by the way. And she even
you want to talk about that?
Well, she mentions in this book that she essentially used menopause as a rocket to reinvigorate her work, which has flown in the face of what some people have said over the years. And I think people have been inspired by her talking in that way.
I don't think, if you think about what the AARP is doing and repositioning itself, you know, their life reimagined. I know that there's, even here, we've got the Second Chance Awards, you know, that are coming up and how people come into life. Formerly, I guess last month, the Jewish Book Festival had, I love this, Thelma Reese, who they partnered with St. John's, who dared senior women to be elder chicks. As I move into my dotage at the age of 52-ish, I think, wow, what's my next step? And that's what the Daring Project is all about. She's collecting. She's really using the new platform of social media to collect daring stories. You know, my mom is 84 years old. She's a Freudian psychoanalyst. Yes, there are still some who are left.
Wow.
And she still sees patients, 3 days a week. It blows me away. So, you know, I want to be that and to emulate the kind of second. Although I see it as it's not a second chance, it's your whole life. You know, it's the expansion of your career. And I think that's really what she did. She saw her life as reinvigorated, but it was all one of the same timeline, if you think about it, Evan, right? She's always been a writer. And it is, how do you re-energize yourself? It's really interesting. I even do this in my work with business leaders, people who are 15 years at a company, 30 years at a company. What's the energy that you're bringing to work? How do you re-up every day, get excited by change that's happening all around you when you're 30 years into a career? I think, you know, we're lucky here in Rochester in that there are companies and people who've had, you know, long-standing careers. That's what she's talking about. It's not just women going through change of life. It's men, too. How do you re-energize your leadership? How do you re-energize your career throughout your life?
Well, and a couple points on there. I remember when I was 23 and I talked to a sociologist who told me, and those things still exist, sociologists still exist,
yes,
too. They told me that research shows you that you really ought to switch careers every 6 years so as not to burn out. Well, first of all, most of us cannot afford to switch careers entirely every 6 years.
Right.
But second of all, I filed that away in my brain and I never forgot that because I do guard against the notion that we can fall into a rut. It's normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, that's absolutely human nature. But Gail Sheehy showed that you don't have to switch careers to reinvigorate. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
You know, and look, you're talking to somebody who a year ago largely switched careers. I mean, still in the broadcast medium, but it was a big change for me. But Gail Sheehy has never felt like you had to switch entirely to reinvigorate. And that is inspiring to me.
I think so. And you know, yes, it might have been. And what she did is she recognizes that we're a whole person. So it's that intellectual capacity to grow. But she was responding to her body and its needs and recognizing that we can't separate ourselves from that. We're whole people throughout our careers. And I think that's really what you're talking about, Evan. It's not about switching careers. It's about paying attention, really listening to your body, recognizing what you need to do to up your energy, and find new ways to do it within the career. It's really interesting. While one would say I switched careers, obviously, going from being a lawyer to being an actor, to being a writer, to being a business consultant, it all makes sense. And to me, it's all part of the same path. And I don't think I could be doing today what I was doing in my business if I hadn't been a lawyer, if I hadn't been an actor, and I hadn't taken the plunge to write a column for the Rochester Magazine.
But then I look at your story and I look at Gail Sheehy's story. And I think about a popular movie that was in theaters a few years ago that had an entirely different message that I disagree with. And the movie was called This Is 40. And This Is 40, the idea of This Is 40 is, you know, the trying to overcome the rut that you get into when you turn 40. And as Paul Rudd says in the film, you know, well, I guess this is it for me. I guess this is it for my life. You know, as it not like it's over, but this is what I will become. This is what you have to accept, that it's not really going to be different, that it may be boring, but that's okay. And again, I take the point to some degree, but I think there's a bit of a pessimistic view that you hit 40 and that there's no room for change or upward mobility or new and exciting things.
It's really unbelievable to me. And to think about what she did after, and I love that she says in the book, you know, I was 36 and I was like, really, you're only 36 and you've done all that? And then I was 57 and, you know, now she's in her 70s and look what she's doing. So I live by this philosophy because, you know, I needed to come up with sort of a template for how I think, because my husband says I'm edgy because he's from Geneva, New York, not Switzerland, and I'm from Staten Island. And I was like, wait, I think that means that I have an edge in a good way. And so I live by this explore, dream, grow, and excite. And it really has meaning to me in everything I do. And that's what I have to remember every day. There's exploring new possibilities every single day. This is meeting you today was a highlight, by the way.
Oh, stop.
But you know, knowing... you never know what's going to happen around the corner. Gail Sheehy doesn't show up. You got to show up. The dream part is really spending your time dreaming. That's what she talks about. Really dreaming big, but you have to re-up for that. I think you have to sort of, okay, today I'm going to dream anew. And that's called, it's called a strategy, an action plan in business. It's just a dream with a bullet point, really. And then the other thing is knowing the stories of your life. That's what I believe, you know, a dream is a story that just hasn't been written yet. So if you understand where you've been, you can know where you're going. And then growing out of your comfort zone. And, you know, look, it's what she did all the time was constantly re-up her going out of her comfort zone. What will I do to grow today? That's what lifelong learning is about. That's what I think she talked about when she re-energized herself. And then the excite part, it's not about, you know, me being excited, but about igniting others, helping them along with their mission, the difference that you can make in your community. I mean, when I think about the fact that she adopted a child in her, what was it, in her 50s?
Yeah, it was 80, it was 19, right around 50, I think.
Yeah, so that's, I would not do that as my children are now 19 and 16. I'm so grateful not to be where you are. But I think she knew that this was a mission that she had, which was to take this young girl and change her life. You can do that in a lot of ways, even just getting involved here in the community. There are so many organizations for which you can make a difference, which in some way is about nurturing and, you know, helping young people and making a difference.
Talking to Pam Sherman, the Suburban Outlaw. And Pam, you can read her work Saturday mornings in the Democrat and Chronicle or sort of in perpetuity online.
Yes.
Pam is a leadership consultant, professor, teacher, writer, actor, used to be an attorney. And she's talking to us about Gail Sheehy's upcoming visit as part of the Jewish Book Festival. Gail Sheehy is the author of the brand new book, Daring My Passages, kind of keeping the theme of passages that she's had for 40 years now as a writer. She's also written really interesting profiles, biographies. I wanted to talk to her about the Clintons, and I'm sure someone will ask her this weekend about
the Clintons. Well, you know, I'll be facilitating the discussion, so tell me what you want me to ask her.
I think you talk about daring. Hillary Clinton has always been a bit of an imposing figure.
Yeah.
And that's part of what they cultivate. It's very difficult to – she's not very accessible to the media. And to some degree, when you've been burned in certain ways, I get it.
Right.
But they're very careful. So when you let somebody in – there has to be intimidation on the writer's part, or I should say, you hope not to be intimidated.
Right.
You hope that you can be strong to write a fair profile and sort of damn the consequences.
Right.
And now you've got Hillary Clinton almost certainly back in the spotlight, the likely nominee for the Democratic Party. And the New York Times writing a story saying she's going to embrace the notion, not to play the woman card, as some people like to sort of haphazardly say, which is silly.
Yeah, I don't get that, because she's an actual woman.
She is an actual woman, yes, right. I think based on what the New York Times was writing, the feeling was 8 years ago, they wanted to be careful not to be viewed as exploiting her gender, as opposed to now saying she is going to be much more comfortable in her own skin. And I would love to know what Gail thinks about that.
Well, especially, there's a whole chapter devoted to her and the Clinton.
The Clinton decade, I think. Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's really interesting to me, because think about 8 years. Why wouldn't she just embrace who she is? I also think she's a grandmother, Hillary Clinton. I would love for Gail to interview her now, because a lot of people have said that has changed her immensely.
I have heard that. Yeah.
Even that role in her life has changed who she is. I never understood that you would not see her for all that she had to offer. You know, it's really interesting. In a lot of the work that I do with women leaders, if I'm working on developing a speech for a CEO, do you know what I pull out? Hillary Clinton's speech to the UN on women's rights. It's an amazing, pull it up online. It's an amazing speech about women in the fields and the factories and the homes, and a real perspective. She did this as first lady. So why would you separate yourself out as a presidential candidate? Those who like her or don't like her, this is a differentiator for her, being a woman candidate. And I mean, I will absolutely ask Gail about her perspective about that candidacy.
I just got an email.
Yes.
That says, please pass along information that her event is sold out now.
Come on.
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
In the last
I don't know
minutes?
When it happened. It might have happened before you even came. I would like to take credit. I don't know if I deserve any.
Please do.
but the Gail Sheehy event is sold out now.
Well, it's interesting. The beauty of this is no, we do love that, because as I started out by saying, the Jewish Book Festival, if you want to come to other events like this, it's now year long, and they're going to be doing more collaborations with other organizations, like they did with St. John's Meadow, like they did with Writers and Books, where they got 400 people to read the same book. This is about really involving the community in the kind of cultural arts. I know for me, it was such a thrill when, so my book is not like yours, an actual book I wrote. It's a compilation of the columns that I've written. I like to say it's the book I've written, not the book I want to write. I love what you wrote. It was amazing. But this idea that there's a place where we could have a forum as local writers, I'm sure that for your next book, you could be in the Jewish Book Festival. We'll find a way to connect it.
They always find a connection. I actually picked up Gail's book and I went, I didn't know she was Jewish.
But this idea that it's expanding the way people think about culture and the arts. You know, when I moved here 13 years ago, the JCC really took me in. I was in the middle of writing a one-woman show, which every actor in Washington needed to have. And I had the opportunity, Herb Katz was the head of cultural arts then, and he said, well, do a reading. Well, let's do a workshop. And, you know, the play went on to be produced by the oldest, back to Women's History Month, the oldest women's theater in the country, Horizons Theater in Washington. I couldn't have done that without the kind of backing that the JCC provides for cultural arts. So the Jewish Book Festival, the Film Festival, and all the work that Ralph Maranto does, it's really exciting.
Ralph is a legend, essentially.
Yeah.
He is amazing. And so, but sorry about the whole sold out thing. That was,
you never know. People don't show up. So,
maybe a line out for Gail Sheehy. Let me, before I grab a phone call, and I've been so head down in the conversation with Pam that I should have mentioned our phone number. It's 844-295-TALK, he says, at 151. What a good look, I've been doing this for 14 months, Pam. 14 months, and this is the latest I've remembered to give the phone number, which goes to show you how much I still have to learn. But
I'd like to think it's about the scintillating conversation.
Well,
that we're
having. I'm giving you the credit there, see? But let me also ask, is there a feeling still? You know, you're someone with a big personality. You've done a lot of different things. You've had moments where you've had to push back a little. Again, the 1990s when they're talking to you about having children and things like that. And we're talking about the Clintons, who Gail Sheehy, of course, has profiled Hillary Clinton. I remember when Tina Fey and Amy Poehler had fun with, but sort of half-hearted, but sort of a serious look at the way we talk about women and the way a strong man is strong and a strong woman's a bitch.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
You know, and that, sorry if I offend anybody, but that's the term they use. Is that still the case? Do you encounter people who have suspicion or have a problem with strong women?
Do I? No, because they wouldn't hire me. I mean, I think that's, they know what they're getting when they see me. I mean, I think that's one of the advantages, by the way, of having a platform, an outspoken platform, is that I have that platform to say what I think publicly in the newspaper. I'm really blessed. I work with a great editor, Mark Liu, over at the DNC, and very grateful to Karen Magnuson and everybody there for the platform that they give me. It's really interesting. I had to travel to Saudi Arabia a few years ago to work with business leaders there. And I can't tell you, you're going to go there where you have to wear an abaya, where women can't drive, they can't vote. I'm so glad I went there and heard the stories of what women are going through. And I couldn't believe that I was even got the offer to speak there. So I don't actually let anything stop me. I don't let it, I'm a woman, I can't go there. I'll go there. I'll be respectful of the rules, but I'm going to be who I am. And I think for women, my biggest piece of advice is you have to be authentic to who you are. You have to be gracious and understand your audience. And I work with women business leaders a lot. I've worked with the Young Presidents Organization around the world, working with women business leaders. I think women have to figure out how to confidently express themselves and be able to counterattack attacks on who they are with confidence of knowing their story and knowing who they are.
Yeah, I don't think that Hillary Clinton lost the primary in 2008 because of her gender. I don't think so. I don't know. I don't think so. I think
it wasn't her time, Evan.
Well, I don't want to get too far in the weeds there. I think there were some potentially strategic mistakes they made as well. But regardless, it drives me nuts when I hear a man use that term for a woman who is essentially just being strong.
Right.
I went back and watched that Tina Fey, Amy Poehler sketch, and they were fired up about it. And Tina Fey said, yeah, she is, and so am I.
Right.
And so is Amy, and deal with it.
Yeah.
That's what strength is.
Honestly,
I hope in 2015, I hope we're generally over that.
Embrace it. It's funny, but I do embrace it with respect. Right? I think that's really it. I mean, I don't want people to think of me as a bitch, but I know there are people who do. I actually get hate mail for my lovely little column on Saturday mornings where I'm just talking, making fun of my husband in print. And I like to think that the only bitch in my house is my little white fluffy dog, right?
Well, I guess what I'm saying, though, is we better be over that.
Yeah.
We better be over the fear of strong women. But yesterday on this program, we were talking about nothing short of the extinction of our species.
Right.
And we've got a population issue. And what blew me away was hearing that if analysts say the equilibrium human population on this planet is roughly 2 billion, mm-hmm. and we're at 7 right. and rising now, how do you get from 7 to 2 without terrible disruption? And he said, empowering women, especially in other countries, but really empowering women, not to the point where you feel good about yourself and, you know,
talking about getting them working
around the world,
right.
really empowering women. And he said, we're not there yet. And that was fascinating to me to hear that.
Well, and it's interesting. It's one of the reasons why locally, and just to bring it back to the community, I love Young Women's College Prep and the charter school for girls and what they're doing. I love the fact that my daughter sits on a grant-making committee for the Women's Foundation, and they're having their purse auction. I love the history of what we have here with the Susan B. Anthony Center, the Susan B. Anthony House. There is so much richness to what we have here in upstate New York. When I moved here, I didn't really get it, I get to tell that story around the world, that I live up the block from where a real outlaw was arrested for voting. So that's not about I think you counteract perception mm-hmm. by sharing stories of strength and success. And if Gail Sheehy represents anything, that's what she represents. And she's still doing it to this day.
Her event's sold out now, but...
But it's exciting that she's coming here.
Absolutely.
To the heartbeat of women's suffrage, I like to say, as I travel around the world, that, Failure is Impossible was founded right here in Rochester, New York. And I get to bring that message to women in Saudi Arabia, women in Oman, the Sultanate
Nigeria.
Of Oman, Nigeria coming up in May, and Cincinnati next week.
I know how Cincinnati feels being roped in there. No, I thank you for taking the time to come in. And if you haven't read Pammy again, you can read her Saturday mornings in the Democrat and Chronicle,
right?
And online, she's known as the Suburban Outlaw, and she's facilitating the discussion with Gail Sheehy at a sold out event on March 4th, just 3 days from now, as part of the Jewish Book Festival. By the way. Should people check out some other things with the Jewish Book Festival? I mean, I've been so locked into this.
Yes, go on to jcc.org, Jewish Book Festival, and Jewish Senior Life is co-sponsoring this event. They have so much to offer as well.
Have fun. I know you will. And thanks very much again. Thanks for dropping off the book. 600 pages. That is it's an amazing, amazing memoir. Thanks.
Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
It is really fun. We should do this once in a while. It's nice to see Pam Sherman. Thanks for listening. Again, first hour tomorrow with Beth Adams. And they're talking about our pets tomorrow in the first hour. Second hour, Innovation Friday. I will talk to you then with Matthew Leonard. Have a wonderful Thursday.